The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to today's podcast, sponsored by Hillsdale College. All things Hillsdale at hillsdale.edu. I encourage you to take advantage of the many free online courses there. And, of course, to listen to the Hillsdale Dialogues, all of them at hughforhillsdale.com, or just Google Apple, iTunes, and Hillsdale.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt, live in the Salem News Channel, ReliefFactor.com studios out west for the last week before I return to the Beltway on Saturday. I'm joined this hour by Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States, former historian extraordinaire at Princeton, a great author of many books, and my friend. Dr. Oren, first of all, I hear you killed it when you were in the desert with an audience a couple of weeks back. My friend Beth was in the crowd and said you really gave quite the remarkable speech. And when she told me that on Friday, I thought, I got to see if Oren will join me on Monday morning to discuss the president's State of the Union and especially the K-Part interview yesterday. So I appreciate your putting aside time for me. We're going to go up and down in order to cover it all. I want to begin by first thanking you, number two. What is your general reaction to both the State of the Union remarks that the president had about Israel and his remarks to Jonathan Capehart, my colleague at The Washington Post yesterday, or on Saturday?
Good morning, Q. It was great to be out in Palm Springs to meet with your friends. As you know, I've been in the United States for a long time now. I'm going home about a week from now. I've been to, I don't know, about 20 different cities across the United States defending the state of Israel at a very, very dark time. And where many communities, particularly Jewish communities across the United States, feel alone, feel beleaguered, and need to hear a message from Israel that we are standing strong. We're not giving in. We're not accepting pressures for a ceasefire, and we're going to defend our state, period. We're going to survive, and we're going to go back to thriving as well. The situation with the Biden administration is very painful. It is very irresponsible, and it is dangerous. It is dangerous, and I'll unpack that at all, one at a time. Painful because, on one hand, the president has opposed ceasefires resolutions in the Security Council. The United States has vetoed three resolutions. And I've said this so many times on this program, I have to say it again, that a ceasefire means, in effect, death for the state of Israel. I mean, it sounds very ameliorative to have a ceasefire. People stop shooting at each other. But what does a ceasefire mean? It means that Hamas gets away with mass murder. Hamas wins. Everything Hamas does, everything Iran does in the Middle East by shooting at American forces, by stopping trade through the Mandeb Straits, is designed to pressure the United States, to pressure Israel to get a ceasefire, because a ceasefire means Hamas wins and Israel dies. Why do we die? Because we can't restore internal security. No one will go back to our border areas. Large swaths of the state of Israel will be rendered uninhabitable. We'll have absolutely no deterrence power in the region. Iran will understand, and I think quite rightly, that it can attack us with impunity. And we won't be able to respond. We won't be able to defend ourselves because the world will tie our hands with a ceasefire each time. And what is left for the state of Israel? Our raison d'etre is to defend the Jewish state, to defend the land of Israel. We won't be able to actually live up to the reason why Israel was created. So a ceasefire being vetoed in this resolutions in the Security Council is very much appreciated and welcome. On the other hand, in addition, the Biden administration has been giving Israel vital forms of munitions, of ammunition, at a time when there's a world munitions shortage because of the Ukraine. Although the type of munitions that the administration has been giving Israel hasn't been heavy munitions, it's been precise munitions, which have a very good effect for, say, you know, eliminating a specific, very specific target in a very specific room. But if you have to, for example, free two hostages in a densely built-up area, those precision bombs won't be of any good. You've got to lay down an artillery barrage of 155-millimeter artillery shells, and that is what is not arriving. And then there's a great shortage there. So we have those two, what I call ammo and veto, that the administration is doing. On the other hand, the administration is coming out virtually nightly now for many weeks and not just intimating, but stating that Israel has been dehumanizing the Palestinians, has been bombing indiscriminately in Gaza, and the rather strange locution used by the Secretary of State has been killing and too many Palestinians. Entirely too many Palestinians have been killed. It was a very strange locution because it suggests that there's a number that would have been okay, right? What's too many? But would be, you know what I'm saying here, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's very strange.
So generally speaking.
Go ahead. I'll unpack all of it.
I got to ask you about the K-Part red line, because the most important thing the president said, in fact, I'll play it for you in order when we get through it. But the president said there's a red line around Rafah. If there is, it's one that should be erased. And I'm sure Israel doesn't see one. What was your reaction to that? Because he kind of stumbled, bumbled into that. I'm not sure that was policy, but he said it.
Well, I don't know if it is policy or isn't policy, but there's no red line. The red line then is Israel's existence. And we cannot do this. You know, there's a history behind this. You know, I'm a historian by training. And if you go back through all of Israel's wars, going back to 1956, and this including the Six-Day War, of course, the Yom Kippur War, the Lebanon War, the 1991 Gulf War, the 2006 Second Lebanon War, all the wars with Hamas, the United States has said to us, stop, and we stopped. You know, the Six-Day War would have been an 8-day war or a 9-day war. The United States stopped, we stopped. This is the time where the United States is going to say, stop. And we're not going to stop because we cannot stop. And Israelis understand that, by the way. There's no big debate in Israel about this. There's no anti-war protests in Israel. There may be out-to-war protests outside the Oscars, but there's none in Jerusalem. There's none in Tel Aviv.
Well, there's an attempt to turn Bibi into the focus of animus, and it's not Bibi. It's nine. Bibi might pay a political price down the road. We don't know. We're not talking about that. We're talking about the war today. 9 out of 10 Israelis support going into Rafah. Am I right about that? 9 out of 10 want Hamas destroyed and the Hunnels destroyed?
I'm surprised only 9 out of 10. They may not have Bibi Netanyahu to kick around anymore. But if he goes, the policies will remain totally unchanged. And in fact, they may even be more aggressive because Netanyahu is notoriously conflict averse. Remember, there was a previous administration that used to call him a certain word, that he was a chicken something, remember? Under Benny Gantz, there would be any difference. No, Yair Lapid, maybe even more aggressive. Because, again, these are existential issues for the state of Israel. They're not negotiable.
Right. I really do want to have you respond piece by piece. So we'll start with the State of the Union. We'll end with the K-Part interview. Cut number 24. This is the president at the State of the Union.
I know the last 5 months have been gut-wrenching for so many people, for the Israeli people, for the Palestinian people, and so many here in America. This crisis began on October 7th with a massacre by a terrorist group called Hamas, as you all know. 1,200 innocent people, women and girls, men and boys, slaughtered after enduring sexual violence. The deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust. And 250 hostages taken. Here in this chamber tonight are families whose loved ones are still being held by Hamas. I pledge to all the families that we will not rest until we bring every one of your loved ones home.
Okay, Dr. Oren, your response to that. That's the start.
That's the start. Okay, that's good. He did that. There were hostage families there. There was actually a released hostage there, Mia Shem. She was 51 days in captivity. It would have been nice if the president had actually acknowledged her presence there, as is traditional during the State of the Union address. If you have a very extraordinary guest in the House, they're usually acknowledged. In this case, she was not. But that was pretty much all he gave to Israel. Then he spent most of his
now remarks, we turn. Let me go through it. Cut number 25. Cut number 25.
Israel has a right to go after Hamas. Hamas ended this conflict by releasing hostages, laying down arms, could end it by releasing the hostages, laying down arms, and surrendering those responsible for October 7th. But Israel has a added burden because Hamas hides and operates among the civilian population like cowards under hospitals, daycare centers, and all the like. Israel also has a fundamental responsibility, though, to protect innocent civilians in Gaza.
Okay, now, Dr. Oren, this is where the turn begins. What did you think of the fundamental responsibility? That's new to the law of warfare. I know the law of warfare a little bit, and I know that Israel is going above and beyond the requirements of the laws of armed conflict. but the president intimates that Israel is not.
Well, you'll see what happens in the next cut. And he goes into greater detail about whether or not Israel is living up to that responsibility that he has established.
Yeah, well, we have 1 minute. I don't want to play that cut until we come back. So don't go anywhere, America, except over to Dr. Michael Oren, Dr. Michael Oren on X, to follow him there. We will post the entire audio, video of this and transcript on the web for you a little bit later today. Dr. Oren, what is your Substack?
It's called Clarity.
That's very easy for people to find. Go and subscribe to it, get it, and get clarity. And then Dr. Oren, of course, is tireless. Are you still working for Hatzalah on this tour, or are you doing this for it's Hatzalah? I've taken Dr. Oren's recommendation as the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt and I have contributed to Hatzalah as, okay, Michael knows where the money ought to go, to the people who are nonpartisan, apolitical, and immediately responding. So I suggest that you go to Hatzalah and become a Hatzalah supporter as well. We'll ask more about that after the break. Stand by. We'll come right back during the break. I'll put it into the podcast, and the hour will continue. Welcome back, America. I'm talking with Dr. Michael Oren this morning. Cut number 26, Joe Biden at the State of the Union, for Dr. Oren to respond to.
This war. Has taken a greater toll on innocent civilians than all previous wars in Gaza combined. More than 30,000 Palestinians have been killed, most of whom are not Hamas. Thousands and thousands of innocents, women and children, girls and boys, also orphaned. Nearly 2 million more Palestinians under bombardment or displacement. Homes destroyed, neighbors in rubble, cities in ruin. Families without food, water, medicine. It's heartbreaking. I've been working nonstop to establish an immediate ceasefire that would last for 6 weeks to get all the prisoners released, all the hostages released, to get the hostages home. And ease the intolerable and humanitarian crisis.
Ambassador Oren, your response.
Well, the situation in Gaza is tragic. It is heartbreaking. That is true. The reason it's heartbreaking is because of Hamas. And the implication here is that Israel has not lived up to its responsibility to protect the civilians of Gaza. We can debate at length the degree to which those civilians bear responsibility for Hamas by voting for Hamas and supporting for Hamas. And the Mia Shem, that the hostage that was released, who was in the audience that night, will tell you that that she believes there's no difference between the people of Gaza and Hamas, that those people of Gaza beat her and spit at her and guarded her and kept her in captivity. But let's not pick, hairs over that. Split hairs over that. I think the major issue here is he has been working day and night to release the hostages, but America's position has what has undermined the hostage negotiations. Because think, if you're Yahya Sinwar, you're the head of Hamas, you're sitting in your tunnel, and you're thinking that if I just hold on for another, say, week or two, I keep on hiding behind my civilian population. I keep on getting that civilian population killed and starved because Hamas is stopping food from getting and stealing food. Because believe me, all the terrorists are very well fed. And eventually, if I hold on, the United States will impose a ceasefire. So why would I give up any hostages right now? Why would I move from my matchless position? Is that Israel will not get a hostage unless it declares that it's lost the war and withdraws all of its troops from Gaza. It is the strangest position, I must say, because if you want the hostages released, you have to convince Sinwar that he's going to die unless he releases the hostages. But the message from Washington is just the opposite.
What about using the Israeli the Gazan health ministry numbers of 30,000? I heard a very detailed explication about why that ought not be the case. Your idea.
Yeah, you probably read the article in Tablet magazine. But of course, yep. I mean, Hamas always inflates it. They also include, what's amazing is, they include in that figure the roughly 13,000 terrorists that Israel has killed. They don't distinguish between the two. And they include in that figure the great numbers of Palestinians who have been killed by rockets falling short. By the way, the word rocket didn't appear anywhere in that speech. I mean, Hamas fired 12,000 rockets at this country. Okay? And there wasn't any reference to Hezbollah also, which is now outfiring Hamas and its rockets. So you have a country under rocket fire. A large part of the country is uninhabitable, not mentioned. And so, if you deduct, the 13,000 Palestinians that we have killed, the terrorists that we have killed, and the Palestinians killed by their own rockets. And by the way, a normal death rate in Gaza, you're going to get something close to a 1-to-1 combatant to civilian,
which is
death
very
ratio,
which very low. It may be the lowest in any major conflict I've ever studied. Stand by. Well, I'll be back with Dr. Michael.
It was in Syria and Afghanistan and Iraq.
Welcome back, America. During the break, which you can hear later on Highly Concentrated Hue, Dr. Oren made the point that the president's use of the number 30,000 Gazans dead includes the 13,000 or more Hamas terrorists who are dead and results in a 1-to-1 or 1-to-1.1 or 1.2 ratio, which I think is the lowest in any major armed conflict of which I'm aware in post-war time and certainly during World War II. Do you agree with that, Dr. Oren? You're a historian. I don't think any major war, and this is a major war, has ever done 1-for-1, a civilian for a fighter.
Yeah, not even the NATO intervention in Serbia in 1999. That was 4-to-1. By the way, all recorded by Brown University. It's public information. This is not disputable. And not just that, the United States in battles like in Mosul and Fallujah was up against a much, much smaller enemy. That was far less dug in. The civilian population could run away. They can't do that very well in Gaza. I don't think any army in history has ever faced the type of challenges that the IDF is facing in Gaza. And I think it has performed admirably. And they'll be studying it in the academies. I don't know what they're going to say in the pages of the New York Times, but in West Point, they're going to be studying this campaign for many years to come.
Cut number 27. The president then introduces a new idea. Cut 27.
The United States has been leading international efforts to get more humanitarian assistance to Gaza. Tonight, I'm directing the U.S. military to lead an emergency mission to establish a temporary pier in the Mediterranean on the coast of Gaza that can receive large shipments carrying food, water, medicine, and temporary shelters. No U.S. boots will be on the ground. A temporary pier will enable a massive increase in the amount of humanitarian assistance getting into Gaza every day.
All right. I think this has got Beirut, 1983, Somalia, Black Hawk Down written all over it. But what do you think of the idea, Dr. Oren?
Well, first of all, according to Israeli sources, this was an Israeli idea that was floated as early as October and not accepted by the United States at the time. You can make the dock. They can bring in the dock. But two things are going to happen. One, how do you get the food from the dock into Gaza? That's the whole issue. The UN won't do it. They're too afraid. The United States won't put boots on the ground, so who's going to end up doing it? We're going to end up doing it. And what's going to happen is Hamas is going to try to prevent the aid. This is difficult to wrap your head around. Hamas wants the population of Gaza to starve, because the more population of Gaza starves, the more pressure we put on Israel by the United States and others to agree to a ceasefire. It all comes down to a ceasefire again. So Israel's going to end up doing it. Israel's going to get shot at. And the next thing that could happen is that someone's going to send a drone to hit one of the ships bringing food.
All right, let me play for you cut 28 because it's connected. Cut 28, please.
And Israel must do its part. Israel must allow more aid into Gaza and ensure humanitarian workers aren't caught in the crossfire.
All right, now I've got to say, Dr. Oren, you just said Hamas wants Gaza to starve. I agree with you. They want Hamas. So this is an appeal to Hamas that left the ceasefire negotiations because they don't want a ceasefire because their objective is dead Jews. Do you think the president doesn't know that?
And dead Palestinians. The way to get more dead Jews is through more dead Palestinians. That would lead to a ceasefire. I think that, you know, there's lots of politics going on here. And, when he talked about his criticism of Israel, received probably the biggest applause of the evening. Missing from that, what can I say, would be the sense that, Israel is our ally, our democratic ally. And we're going to stand four square behind Israel and not let Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas, to conclude that he can get between us, that he can insinuate himself between us, and that we're going to start pressuring Israel for a ceasefire. Just the opposite. The message to Washington, to Sinwar, is hold on. Hold on. Hope is coming.
Yeah. If I had been the president of the United States, I would have said the equal of any of our allies, Israel, has suffered a devastating blow, and we will stand by with them until the enemy is eliminated, as it was eliminated in Germany and Japan. and as we originally eliminated Al-Qaeda. We're coming right back, Dr. Oren, so do not go anywhere. America, I remind you, this will be all of it, including I'm going to talk with Dr. Oren during the break about the last part of the State of the Union. Then, and when we come back on air, we'll talk about Jonathan Capehart. We'll spend the hour doing this so that you have a comprehensive response from a longtime figure in American and Israeli politics, Ambassador Dr. Michael Oren. Dr. Oren, Princeton historian, author of many great books, and also the Substack is Clarity, and you ought to be listening to Dr. Oren everywhere. Read his book, Ally, is a very, very good book. 2048, Beth asked me about last night. It's a great book, but it was written before 10/7, so he's going to have to revise it on the needs coming up. But follow Dr. Oren on X at Dr. Michael Oren and understand that's about as smart a take as you can get from a government, from a person outside of the government who knows what's going on inside of the government. Stand by. I'll be right back with Dr. Oren. Welcome back, America. I'm rejoined by Dr. Oren for the part of the podcast that will appear off air. Dr. Oren, I want to play for you cut 29 and 30. It's the last of the two cuts from the President's State of the Union.
As we look to the future, the only real solution to the situation is a two-state solution over time. And I say this as a lifelong supporter of Israel. My entire career, no one has a stronger record with Israel than I do. I challenge any of you here. I'm the only American president to visit Israel in wartime. But there is no other path that guarantees Israel's security and democracy. There is no other path that guarantees that Palestinians can live in peace with peace and dignity. And there's no other path that guarantees peace between Israel and all of its neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, with whom I'm talking.
And cut 29.
Creating stability in the Middle East also means containing the threat posed by Iran. That's why I built a coalition of more than a dozen countries to defend international shipping and freedom of navigation in the Red Sea. I've ordered strikes to degrade the Houthi capability and defend U.S. forces in the region. As Commander-in-Chief, I will not hesitate to direct further measures to protect our people and our military personnel.
All right, Dr. Oren, I don't think we're containing Iran, the opposite, and I don't believe a two-state solution is going to happen in my lifetime, your lifetime, or the lifetime of my children, and hopefully my grandchildren. What do you think?
No, and I think that right now, certainly, that the vast majority of Israelis would not be willing to remotely entertain the thought, including the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, who is the former head of the Labor Party, who in Davos recently said that they'll talk about a two-state solution this time is sheer madness. No one, who is going to run that state? Is it going to be the Palestinian Authority? Mahmoud Abbas, who's in the 19th year of his four-year term, will not stand for re-election because 85% of the Palestinians in the West Bank support Hamas. So, yes, you know, he can say, as American leaders have said now for some 31 years, the only path to peace is a two-state solution. It's tragic because there are other paths that are actually blocked because of this obsession with a two-state solution, which isn't going to happen in the short run. I mean, if I were, you know, running Israel, I would say to Joe Biden, we can discuss a path. A path is a thing with gravel and shrubbery. It doesn't commit us in any way. But, you know, putting emphasis on the two-state solution, I think, is very, very counterproductive. It obviates other issues, other venues, such as federative solutions, cantonment solutions on the Swiss model. There are other ways you can go. But no one's pausing to say, what does this state mean? What does it look like? Is it democratic? Is it imposed? Is leadership imposed by the United States? Is it demilitarized in any way? No one, that's the mantra, the two-state solution. And unfortunately, people buy into it.
Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said that Joe Biden is famous for famously being wrong about everything involving national security for 40 years at the time. Now it's 50 years. I understand it's a talking point and it's for domestic political consumption. But does it, in fact, lose his ability to get Israeli population to listen to him when he talks about what is, in effect, an alternative reality that doesn't exist?
I think it's just a part of a general approach, which is, again, it's counterproductive. We again, Israel's going to appreciate the vetoes cast against the ceasefire. It's going to appreciate the munitions that have been supplied to us. But there's been a major deterioration in the American position to Israel since that visit by the president during wartime, and certainly his speech of right after the horrors of October 7th was deeply appreciated by the Israeli people. Right now, the message, again, coming out of Washington is for Hamas to hold fast. The ceasefire is coming from the United States, talking about a red line. What is the red line? The red line, you cross the red line, what is America not going to support Israel anymore? If you're Yahya Sinwar, again, you're thinking, okay, let's get Israel to cross that red line. And there'll be that breakdown. Not a word, God, not a word about Hezbollah in the north.
We will be right back. We're going to come right back with Come to Jesus Talk. Michael, who grew up in New York, absolutely understands what a Come to Jesus meeting is. And we'll talk about the appropriateness of the president saying that, as well as just what it means. He says inappropriate things all the time. We don't worry about it. But for those of you who are wondering why I'm talking to Dr. Oren, headline, sharpening criticism, Biden says Netanyahu hurting Israel more than he's helping. He's wrong. PM bluntly rejects Biden critique. Another headline, Middle East crisis, Biden Netanyahu dispute over Gaza war heats up. In the Wall Street Journal, bid to pause Israeli Hamas war falters before Ramadan strikes. And then Hezbollah bombards north with rockets after deadly IDF strike. I'll be back to talk about all those things and what the president had to say to Capehart. Jonathan Capehart, my MSNBC and Washington Post, my old and current colleague, right after this. Stay tuned. America, I'm Hugh Hewitt, back with Dr. Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He's in the States. He's joining me early for an entire hour because an Israeli's response, as I did with Aviv Redegur on Friday, is important. But Dr. Oren's a senior statesman kind of guy in Israel, and I thought we should ask him. All right. Immediately after the State of the Union, the president hangs around, talks to Michael Bennett of Colorado, says this to him, cut number one. So what happens there is that Secretary Buttigieg and Secretary Blinken are standing next to the president when Michael Bennett, senator from Colorado, approaches him, says we need more aid for Gaza. He said, don't tell anyone, but I told Bibi we've got to have a come to Jesus meeting on that. That's tin-eared. That's the best I can say, tin-eared. What did you think about that, Dr. Oren?
Well, I don't think that comment is as damaging as some of the comments made Vice President Kamala Harris, where she says she distinguishes, the Biden administration distinguishes between the government of Israel and the people of Israel. And I, an Israeli, am very offended by that. I'm not going to defend our government, certainly not many policies, and certainly not many of the ministers in that government who I find offensive. But what that remark says is that we don't really respect Israeli democracy. And Israel being, you know, one of the few countries in the world that has never known a second of non-democratic governance, and the only country on that list that's never known a moment of peace, I think a little respect for our democracy from our democratic ally is called for. Don't you, Hugh?
I do, but I don't think you're going to get it from this Democratic Party. I do believe you're going to see a significant realignment of the American Jewish vote after this. But let's keep going. Jonathan Capehart yesterday, now on Saturday, begins to work through the State of the Union in the aftermath because the fallout was intense, both from the left and the right, and the center even took notice of it. Cut number one, this is Joe Biden with on MSNBC with my Washington Post colleague, Jonathan Capehart. Cut number two.
You were caught on a hot mic after your State of the Union address talking to Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Senator Michael Bennett, saying, quote, I told him, Bibi, and don't repeat this, but you and I are going to have a come to Jesus meeting. What do you mean by that?
What I meant was, it's an expression used in the southern part of my state, meaning a serious meeting. And it was, I've known Bibi for 50 years, and he knew what I meant by it.
So what's the come to Jesus part? What tough love are you going to give to the prime minister?
What's happening is he has a right to defend Israel. a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by making the rest of the world, it's contrary to what Israel stands for. And I think it's a big mistake. So I want to see a ceasefire.
What I'm so astonished by that 1 minute. It's not even the worst part of the interview, but what do you think about that, Dr. Horn?
I'm going to say, at the risk of repeating myself many times, it's the message to Sinwar, hold on. And, you know, if we're BB to go tomorrow, and I have a bit of a debate with some of my colleagues about this, how many days of grace it would give us? Because the policy is not going to change one iota. Nothing. And the big debate in Israel, Hugh, is not whether Israel is killing too many Palestinians, but whether we're jeopardizing the lives of our soldiers by taking extraordinary efforts to limit Palestinian casualties. And soldiers are coming out of Gaza furious. We've had protests by soldiers get zero credit for this. And again, the message is the wrong message. Bibi could go tomorrow and maybe get 3 or 4 days of grace from the press and maybe from the president. But at the end of the day, the policies remain unchanged because, again, I'm just repeating myself. This is an existential battle.
And OK, here is the heart of the controversy. Cut 6 and 7 back to back, please. Take about a minute and a half. Cut 6 and 7 of President Biden with Jonathan Capehart.
What is your red line with Prime Minister Netanyahu? Do you have a red line? For instance, would invasion of Rafah, which you have urged him not to do, would that be a red line?
It is a red line, but I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if he crosses and he cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead as a consequence of going after. There's other ways to deal, to get to deal with the trauma caused by Hamas. And it's like, look, the first time I went over, I sat with them and I sat with a war captain. I said, look, don't make the mistake America made. America made a mistake. We went after bin Laden until we got him. But we shouldn't have gone into Ukraine. I mean, we shouldn't have gone into the whole thing in Iraq and Afghanistan. It wasn't necessary. It wasn't necessary. It just caused more problems in the race than it's been cured.
Who actually wants a deal? Do you think Hamas actually wants a ceasefire?
Well, I think Hamas would like a total ceasefire across the board because they have a better chance to survive and maybe rebuild. But that's not what I think the vast majority of people think. You have to look. After what happened in World War II and the carpet bombing that took place, what happened was we ended up in a situation where we changed the rules of the game, what constitutes legitimate rules of war.
That makes no sense, by the way, Dr. Oren, in terms of what he's trying to connect the dots. But he realizes he stepped in it when he said Hamas wants a ceasefire so they can survive. He admitted your point, which you've been making repeatedly. But the red line stuff calls to mind Syria, calls to mind you may not go into Rafah. And it's like a load of bricks dropping.
Well, on the contrary, you know, President Obama didn't uphold his red line in Syria.
Correct.
The danger here that there actually is a line that somebody in Washington would want to uphold. Again, the implication is that we've killed 30,000 Palestinians. We've done this maliciously, that we've bombed indiscriminately, and that somehow this is the policy of Bibi Netanyahu. It's wrong, and unfair. And I think it's deleterious to our position. It's deleterious to America's position. I think the message to the world is, you know, we're not going to stick by this ally. I know, you know, Joe Biden's been a great friend, and you know I've worked with him, and I have a very high regard for him and his staff. I think there are major policy failures going on here, big mistakes.
I do want to emphasize, for fairness purposes, the only time I've met the president when he was a senator. I was talking to and at broadcasting from the AIPAC conference in the early aughts. And he stopped by and we had a 30-minute conversation about supporting Israel. I don't know what's happened, except that the people around him are not the people that he used to be. One more cut to play for you, then I'm just going to open up. Cut, this is the prime minister responding to Axel Springer yesterday about the red line. Cut number 8.
Well, I don't know exactly what the president meant. But if he meant by that, then I'm pursuing private policies against the majority, the wish of the majority of Israelis, and that this is hurting the interests of Israel, then he's wrong on both counts. Number one, these are not my private policies only. They're policies supported by the overwhelming majority of the Israelis. They support the action that we're taking to destroy the remaining terrorist battalions of Hamas. They say that once we destroy the Hamas, the last thing we should do is put in Gaza, in charge of Gaza, the Palestinian Authority that educates its children towards terrorism and pays for terrorism. And they also support my position that says that we should resoundingly reject the attempt to ram down our throats a Palestinian state. That is something that they agree on, and it's something that I think is also for the interests of Israel, because the majority of Israelis understand that if we don't do this, what we'll have is a repetition of the October 7th massacre, which is bad for Israel, bad for the Palestinians, bad for the future of peace in the Middle East. So the attempt to say that my policies are my private policies that are not supported by most Israelis is false. The vast majority are united as never before, and they understand what's good for Israel.
So, Dr. Oren, you have known the Prime Minister a long time, but I want the audience to know that you've served in a party other than Likud. You are critical of Benjamin Netanyahu when you want to be. You're supportive when you want to be. I think he's 100% right here. But what do you, the former ambassador of Israel to the United States, think about what the Prime Minister said?
Well, here it is. If you look at our polls in our country, the vast majority of Israelis would like Benjamin Netanyahu to resign. But the same 80% of Israelis don't want this war to end. So he's absolutely right. They're not his policies. It's the state of Israel's policies. And there's a great confusion, I think deliberate confusion, on the part of people in Washington. Because, yes, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. military is the president of the United States. But the commander-in-chief of the Israel Defense Forces is not the prime minister. It's not the defense minister. It's not the chief of staff. The prime minister can't make policy by himself in the state of Israel. He doesn't command the army. The army is commanded by a government. And it's commanded by a war cabinet that includes Benny Gantz, for example, in it. He's making these decisions also. And so the attempt to impute all the blame to Benjamin Netanyahu is deeply inaccurate. Maybe they want to get that straw man up there and beat the hell out of him. But were he to go tomorrow, again, that policy would remain utterly, utterly unchanged.
So, Dr. Oren, is the red line that the president puts out there really a red line, not just around Rafah, but around Hezbollah in the north, the Houthis, and Iran? Is it really a red line that says Israel has to go no further to defend itself? And maybe even the West Bank terrorists, because once you start imposing red lines to protect terrorists, I don't know where you stop.
Well, keep in mind, I try to see various, crises from the perspective of the actors involved. I've several times made reference to the fact that this is the way Yahya Sinwar sees this. But it's also, you have to look at the way Hassan Nasrallah, the head of Hezbollah, is looking at this and looking at the United States tying Israel's hands, trying to avoid a regional conflict. And I understand that from the administration's point of view. The last thing they want is get dragged into a Middle East war right now. And the criticism of the president's handling from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and other constituencies in the United States is costing him politically. I understand all that. But the message to the region is that the United States is going to tie Israel's hand, and so it's open season. And I think that is a dangerous policy. And my big fear, Hugh, is that Hassan Nasrallah and his brother are waiting like Sinwar is waiting for a breakdown in U.S.-Israel relationship. At that point, they will release the 150,000 rockets in their arsenal. And Hamas is a tactical threat to the state of Israel. Hezbollah is a strategic threat to the state of Israel.
Stand by. I'll be right back with Dr. Oren during the break. And we have three more segments with him. So don't go anywhere. He's being very generous this morning. But I want a comprehensive view out there of an Israeli diplomat's response to the president's rather erratic comments in the State of the Union, and then his mystifying comments to Jonathan Capehart and to Michael Bennett. Stay tuned. I am back with Dr. Michael M. Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States. He's touring the United States, as he often does. I don't know if you're touring for United Hatzalah this time. Are you, Dr. Oren?
Yeah, I am this evening. I'll be for Hatzalah this evening in Philadelphia.
Would you explain just briefly what Hatzalah is and why every Republican, Democrat, Independent, any American friend of Israel can support Hatzalah without involving themselves in politics?
Atsala is the world's largest volunteer emergency medical service. It's 7,500 paramedics, Jews, Arabs, religious, secular, women, men, who are on 24/7 call to assist and save Israelis, Palestinians. The major vehicle is an ambulocycle. It's a motorcycle that does everything an ambulance does, except take you to the hospital. But it saves the lives. And in an urban environment, Hasala will get to you within 90 seconds. In an agrarian and agricultural area, within 3 minutes. Saves hundreds, thousands of lives every year. During this crisis, Hasala was the first on the ground. We've had volunteers, including two Arab volunteers, who were killed on October 7th, others taken into hostage, taken into captivity. And I'm here helping to raise money to replenish the supplies of Hasala, expand the medical services. You know, every dollar given to Hasala is going to saving human lives.
It may be the only word in Hebrew that I can pronounce, Hatzalah, because it's all A. So it's United Hatzalah. And if you go on Google, you're able. It's true. I butcher Hebrew pretty badly. All right, let's get back to the substance here. The imminence of a war on the north, Dr. Oren. I want to close with our last three segments. I read to you that Hezbollah bombarded the north with rockets yesterday. I mean, bombarded it. It was dozens. How long will Israel put up with this? We have about 3 minutes to coming back.
Well, not very long. I mean, the cards on the table. Back in the early October, I called for Israel to focus on the north and freeze the situation in the south because Hamas wasn't going anywhere, because Hamas is a tactical threat and Hezbollah is a strategic threat. Its rockets can take out all of our essential utilities, our airports, our army bases, and Dimona. And they have 100,000 terrorists.
Dimona being the site of nuclear weapon research and storage. Allegedly.
Our nuclear facility.
Yeah.
On a nuclear facility, 100,000 terrorists who have been assiduously massacring Syrians for the last decade, half a million Syrians. So this is a strategic threat to the state of Israel. The entire northern part of our country is uninhabitable right now. And that is an intolerable situation from any sovereign country, certainly for the state of Israel, threatened with national destruction by Hezbollah and its Iranian backers. So Israel is going to have to take measures. We simply, again, it's an existential moment. It's not a security issue. And I don't know why, you know, we're waiting. We are probably waiting to conclude the campaign against Hamas, to give our army a little break, to store up on ammunition, and waiting for clear skies as well. You may notice historically, we fight our wars between June and October because of those clear skies. My big fear is that Hezbollah will act first. And it has been my fear since October that we will lose the, you know, the benefit of the first strike capability against Hezbollah. In any case, it will be a very difficult campaign. We'd have to move our army into southern Lebanon. The 150,000 rockets are situated under some 200 Lebanese villages.
A tunnel complex, do you think, at least the equal of Hamas tunnel complex in Gaza?
Of a different measure, because is the rate of fire from Hezbollah rockets. Hamas fired 12,000 rockets at Israel since October 7th. The rate of fire from Hezbollah is estimated by the IDF to be as much as 6,000 rockets a day.
Wow.
Again, these are bigger rockets, longer rockets, and
right.
Very accurate rockets.
If you stand by, Dr. Oren. We're coming back onto the radio show. Welcome back, America. I'm with Dr. Michael Oren. Former ambassador of Israel to the United States, historian extraordinaire, touring the United States on behalf of Hatzalah, United Hatzalah. He'll be in Philadelphia this evening. Dr. Oren, I got to ask you from your historian's hat, is there a chance that this is actually something Khomeini figured out? Let's get Hamas to do the massacre, draw Israel in, wear out America and the world's support for Israel, let them forget 10/7. Then roll out the Houthis to destroy shipping, then roll out Hezbollah, and in the end, we'll deliver a coup de grace. I mean, could there be a plan here?
Well, I want to say I'm not a prophet, but on October 5th, I was in Dallas giving a speech to a real estate group. And I said to the audience, I said, I don't want to scare you, but I think Israel's going to be going to war soon. And there was a gasp. And then I explained that the Biden administration is trying to broker peace between Israel and Saudi Arabia. It had a strategic component, an economic component. It also had a nuclear component. Saudi Arabia was going to get nuclear power. And I said the Iranians are going to be damned if they're going to sit back quietly and let this happen. They're going to move to defend, to destroy it, and just by starting a local war. And they did. I think that we haven't found the smoking gun yet. I think we're going to find it. A lot of circumstantial evidence points to the fact that the Iranians were behind this. And yes, ever since then, the policy of Iran has been to pressure the United States, to pressure Israel to a ceasefire. Again, we're always going to come back to that ceasefire, whether by stopping shipping through the Mandeb Straits or firing repeatedly at American bases in Syria, Iraq, and Jordan. That's what it's about. And Iran could end up winning massively because no one will take Iran. Iran has not paid any price for any of this. Zero. After that tragic strike on the base that killed three American service people, I suggest that the United States blow up the factory that created the drone that killed the soldiers, because that would be a double blow, a blow to Iran, but also a blow to Russia, which is using those drones to kill Ukrainians. But no price was exacted from Iran in any way. The United States bombed various proxies, and Iran doesn't care about the proxies. They're willing to fight those proxies to the last Iraq to kill Americans.
The president did not mention the meteoric rise in anti-Semitism in the United States. Do you think he ought to have done so? And do you think this is so political? It's all about our November election and not about Israel's survival at this point.
Yes, he should have. And I understand, again, politically why he hasn't. One of my messages to American Jewish leadership, and I've been traveling across the United States, as you know, is that, not to get involved in partisan politics, not to get involved in the 2024 elections, but there has to be some pushback here. And because the only pushback is coming from that branch of the Democratic Party, which is opposing the degree to which the president is supporting the state of Israel. But you can criticize the administration's policy without saying, I'm not going to vote for the president, or I'm going to vote for Donald Trump. Criticism should be voiced. And this was an exquisite, a great moment for pouring out anti-Semitism and supporting the American Jewish community, because these communities that I'm meeting, Hugh, I've never seen anything like this. And, I've been in this field a long time. I've seen fear in the face of American Jews, deep fear. And that's an extremely worrisome notion. I call attention to an article that's in The Atlantic by my former editor at The New Republic, Frank Foyer. It's a very disturbing article about the end of the golden age of American Jewry and what American Jews are facing today.
John Podhoretz also wrote in commentary, "They're coming for us." And those are the two keystone articles. But John Podhoretz and Abe Greenwald, also of commentary, have had a 6-month or 5-month debate about whether Biden is talking tough about Netanyahu and Israel, but doing everything Israel needs. Abe Greenwald saying, no, Biden's going to screw Israel. I'm with Abe. Who are you with?
The jury's out, but I'm concerned because the damage has already been done already. Again, I fault many people in Washington for strengthening the position of Hamas and leading Hamas to conclude that it has everything to gain by holding on and not conceding, not giving up hostages. And I think that's tragic. I think it's tragic for Israel, certainly tragic for the hostages, and ultimately tragic for the Palestinians themselves.
I'm going to have one last question for Dr. Oren, but if you want to hear his assessment of what is going on in the politics of America as a result of this, you're going to have to wait and go find the podcast on Highly Concentrated Hugh, which will be up by 10 o'clock Eastern time today, because I got Dr. Oren up early. I don't know where he is, but he's up early, and I appreciate it very much. We have one more segment with you. Where are you right now, Dr. Oren?
I am in northern New Jersey. My mother has passed away 2 months ago, and I'm cleaning out the house I grew up in.
Oh, that's an emotionally fraught time. Dr. Oren, thank you again. Thank you for spending time with us. We'll be right back. One more segment with Dr. Oren after these messages. Stay tuned. This will entirely be posted at Highly Concentrated Hugh at iTunes, Spotify, the Salem Podcast Network, and wherever podcasts are. Dr. Oren's Substack, which is briefly named Clarity, is a must-read in these times, especially in the months ahead, because this is going to get worse before it gets better. And Israel's not going to respect some pretend red line laid down by the president of the United States, maybe unintentionally. Couldn't even get through an MSNBC interview with Jonathan Capehart without. And then Kamala Harris is a wholly different thing. But we'll talk politics after the break on the conclusion of the podcast portion of today. So stay tuned, America. I'll be right back with Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador to the United States. His book, Ally, A-L-L-Y, is a great summary of how Israel and the United States has conducted its relationship between two sovereign states that have often agreed but sometimes disagreed. And I don't think we've disagreed this badly since 1956. Stay tuned for one more segment with Dr. Oren. I am back with Dr. Michael Oren for a concluding couple of comments on the state of the Democratic Party. Dr. Oren, in 1956, Ike pulled the plug on the Suez Canal. And he was very upset. It was before an election. That was a Republican president. And support for Israel wasn't as bedrock as it is in the United States now. I joked with Aviv Redinger. I'm sure you run into a lot of Irish Catholic Zionists out there. But the number are growing. And Aviv argued that this is the greatest thing for creating Zionists on American campuses that he's ever seen. But he's only in his 40s. You and I are a little bit older. What is happening to the Democratic Party in Israel? Because this is a break.
Debate, certainly for the time being, and there was a break with the Republicans in the 1950s. By the way, Eisenhower, looking back on the Suez Crisis of 56, said it was the greatest single foreign policy mistake he made, bailing out Nasser and basically betraying his allies, the French, the British, and the Israelis. And if he hadn't, if Nasser had been brought down in 1956, you wouldn't have had a 1967 war. You wouldn't have had a 1973 war. You think about it, just the ramifications of that policy failure. And I hope America is not repeating that failure, which could have, you know, a domino effect that would span decades. And that is a definite fear. Listen, the same time that the New York Times rants against us with four or five front page articles every single day designed to delegitimize us, and you see this in much of the American media, a recent Harvard poll, and I know you have a certain respect for this university still, a recent Harvard poll came out and said that 82% of Americans favor Israel in this battle. And no one's, you know, no one's canvassing the opinions of people outside, say, of New York and Los Angeles or Chicago. But there's an America out there that remains very, very pro-Israel. And I encountered that with your friends in Palm Springs. That audience was largely not Jewish, just resoundingly pro-Israel. And I think that reflects much of American public opinion, who understands that this is not a battle between Israel and Hamas, or even Israel and Gaza, the Palestinians. It's a battle for Western civilization. It's a
Beth emphasized from your talk, and which triggered my late night call last night, is you stressed resilience. And I thought I translated that into determination to see it through. Hamas cannot survive, or they've said they'll do it again. And the mask is off by what they mean by that. They just mean killing Jews.
It was great, you know, with that, the Palm Springs audience, if I will, I could talk about evil in the world. And Hamas is evil, and we are facing that common evil. And that is why we have to prevail. Yes, it's essential for Israel's survival. It is a war. It's an existential struggle. But it's even more than that. The struggle for our civilization, the struggle for everything we value and hold dear, for our families and for our core beliefs. And people who understand, you know, there's nobody I can think of. I'm looking across this administration. I don't see anybody who's actually held a gun and actually been in urban combat. But I have, and most of my family has, and no, war is horrible. War is miserable. Israel is doing its utmost to limit those civilian casualties, and we're paying a price for it. And that is a message that we have to get across. And I think the majority of Americans, those who aren't reading the New York Times or believing the New York Times, understand that, and they understand it intrinsically.
And, you know, I have recommended, I'll be recommending in the Post today or tomorrow, I don't know when the column published in the Washington Post, that former President Trump named Tom Cotton or Mike Pompeo or Joni Ernst, and there are a few others like J.D. Vance and Mike Gallagher who've held a gun in the Middle East and done what you've said. I want a warrior, because I just don't think Kamala Harris has any idea what you're talking about. And let's close there. The vice president also made a speech. It's even further to the left than Joe Biden. Has that party just decided they're in with the left and the left hates Israel?
I think that this, again, it's an election year and we're talking about politics. There is a strange, I don't know, I almost want to call it a fetish. These are people who haven't necessarily shed many tears over the massacre of 500,000 Syrians, didn't shed many tears over the abandonment of hundreds of thousands of Afghanis, particularly Afghani women. But this deep, deep obsession with Palestinian losses, that's just become part of the political landscape generally in the United States over the course of several decades now. And it's come
well,
to,
why
come
is that? Dr. Oren, you've been in and out of government. You're the deputy minister. You're the ambassador. Is Israel just terrible at public diplomacy?
Well, we always be better at public diplomacy. But at the end of the day, this is all happening because we are the Jewish state. But as the Jewish state, we'll be treated as Jews, held to completely different moral standards. The only reason people are obsessed with the Palestinians is because they're enemies of the Jews. When Syrians were massacring Palestinians, nobody cared. When Kuwait kicked 400,000 Palestinians out of Kuwait after the 1991 Gulf War, nobody cared. Hey, when Hamas killed 600 Palestinian policemen in 2007, when it took over the Gaza Strip, nobody cared. They only care because the Palestinians have us as an enemy. And I always say that the Palestinians should, you know, bless their stars that they have us as an enemy, because nobody would care. People would care about as much as they cared when Bashar al-Assad massacred 500,000 of his own countrymen, and America didn't intervene, not even to enforce that red line.
Very last question, Dr. Oren. Is it possible to be anti-Zionist but not anti-Semitic? Because I don't believe that. I believe anti-Zionism is just code word that keeps people feeling good that they're not anti-Semitic. But I just think they are.
Well, if there's any sort of silver lining to this whole crisis, and there have been silver linings, it's revealed Israel is the most resilient society on earth. It's brought us together. It's reminded us that we are a nation, we're people. It's taught us who our friends are in the world. But it's also resolved that great question, is anti-Zionism synonymous with anti-Semitism? It's been resolved. The people who are calling to throw Jews, who are protesting for Palestine, for Hamas, and saying throw Jews back in the gas chambers, they've resolved that question. I think most American Jews understand this is not an educational moment. They're not going to sit down with these people and remind them about the Holocaust. I think they're reminded of the Holocaust in a very good way. The anti-Semitism today is a completely different. Now it's actually become morally superior to be anti-Zionist and anti-Semitic. Clearly, it is not anti-Semitic to be critical of Israel. I think I'm critical of Israel. You've heard it on this program. But it is anti-Semitic to say that Jews are the only people on earth that do not deserve a state. It is anti-Semitic to hold Israel to a completely different moral standard than any other democracy in the world. It's anti-Semitic to call for Israel's destruction. And this is precisely what these protesters are doing out in the street. They're calling for Israel's destruction.
Dr. Michael Oren, again, thank you for an entire hour. Very early on the East Coast. Good luck tonight with United Hatzalah appeal in Philadelphia. And I will talk to you again on the radio soon. Thank you for joining me. Want to remind everyone, a great sponsor of the program is MyPhDWeightLoss.com. Generalissimo went on that program more than a year ago, lost 50 pounds. He's kept it off. And stress eating is not allowed, I don't believe, even though we're under a lot of...
Sure tempted to this week, aren't we?
Everybody is. But we don't... I'm sure they give you tricks of the trade to combat that, because that's one of the habits. You broke that habit. You're not going by Del Taco or Taco Bell.
Have not. No.
You haven't relapsed.
Have not relapsed.
And that is... And it's healthy, it's wise, it's productive.
864-644-1900.
That's...
864-644-1900.
You and contributing colleague at the Washington Post joins me. Jim, I talked for a full hour with Dr. Michael Oren this morning about the Capehart interview in which the president says, or Jonathan asks, are there red lines? And the president says, yes, they can't go into Rafah. I'm astonished by this. I think we're going to have a realignment of Friends of Israel and American Jewry in the election of 2024. What do you think?
It feels like the entire U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is being rapidly recalibrated to make sure Joe Biden gets enough votes in Dearborn, Michigan.
Yeah.
That in the end, that this is a panic over Biden and that uncommitted vote in Michigan, which, by the way, wasn't actually that high.
And Minnesota was higher. Minnesota was 20%. Minnesota was higher.
And if you ask me, look, if Biden was doing better on the economy and inflation and prices, if Biden was doing better on the border, if Biden didn't come across, other than on the State of the Union night, which I'll say for him was very fired up, but most of the time he comes across as a doddering old 81-year-old. If he didn't have those weaknesses, his numbers in Michigan would be fine. So the only reason that they're really focusing on, oh, my goodness, we've got this major problem with the Israel issue, we're losing votes amongst Arab Americans, we're losing votes amongst Muslims, we got to bend over backwards to win these people back. First of all, most of these people are never coming back. Once they start calling you Genocide Joe, they're not going to say, ah, but you know what? He recognized a Palestinian state, so he's okay now. We're cool. Or he really denounced Bibi Netanyahu, and behind the scenes, he calls him the A word. No, people are not going to, you know, these folks are going to probably vote for Cornel West. Or somebody else, maybe RFK Jr., I don't know, or they'll leave it blank, that a lot of these people are not going to come back into the Biden camp. And I think this is a reflection of the Biden team. I don't know whether they spend time on Twitter or X. Sorry, Elon. I don't know if they spend time on Threads. I don't know, but they're in a social media environment in which support for Israel is really controversial. That
Jim,
is not
I like
the case both nationwide.
I like to give the president credit. The only time I've interviewed him, he was then Senator Joe Biden. I was speaking at and broadcasting from APAC, American Israeli Political Action Committee, at Washington, D.C., and Joe Biden has a long record of supporting Israel, which he referred to in the State of the Union. But he is 81. The Democratic Party that's under 50 is anti-Israel, and Kamala Harris is their spokesperson. She is their clarion call, and she is anti-Israel. And that's interesting. She's married to Doug, and Doug is Jewish, of course. She doesn't want to say that, but you can't make the statement she makes and understand it to be other than pro-Palestinian and pro-radical Palestinian.
And according to NBC News, Hugh, that was the watered-down version of the speech. That was the mild version. We're all operating on the assumption that at some point between, assuming Joe Biden gets reelected, I think the odds of that are less than, I thought going into the State of the Union it was less than 50-50. Maybe it's closer to 50-50. But, at some point between January 20th, 2025 and January 20th, 2029, Kamala Harris would probably become president of the United States. It is extremely unlikely that Joe Biden remains president at age 86. At that point, it's the Harris administration, and she decides what U.S. policies towards Israel and the Palestinians and the rest of the Middle East is. And it is every reason to think, whether it's still Bibi Netanyahu running the country or some other Israeli, the Biden administration really wants to believe that this is going into Ramallah. Oh, that's just Bibi being a crazed warmonger. My understanding is public opinion polling in Israel is like there's pretty still widespread support. And there are people who really don't like Bibi Netanyahu who feel like he's doing what he has to do in the Gaza Strip and that they have to go into Ramallah and that the war can't end until Hamas is effectively eliminated or nullified as a factor in the for years to come.
Jim, I try and read all of your Washington Post columns and, of course, the Morning Jolt. And my next Post column, which will be out today or tomorrow, is about how you want the former president needs to contrast sharply via his selection of vice president with Kamala Harris, both as to intellectual ability, grasp, and ideology. My short list is now Cotton, Ernst, and Pompeo. I understand there are other peoples on there like Elise Stefanik and, believe it or not, Ben Carson is on that list. I understand all that, but I want a veteran who is smart. Really smart. And can contrast with Kamala, who's on Garrity's short list that you wish Donald Trump would think about.
In a normal campaign, Trump would be picking somebody like Nikki Haley, unifying the party, and that offsetting balance, that JFK with LBJ, this idea of like, okay, there's some people in the party who don't like me, but look at this person,
Reagan
this person
Bush,
be advising me. This person,
Reagan what? Bush.
I'm sorry.
Reagan Bush in 1980.
The names you mentioned are fine. I think the worst possible scenario is somebody who comes across as a lickspittle sycophant. Carrie Lake would probably be the quintessential example of what you don't want. But Trump's got a huge ego, and I don't think he likes having anybody around. I don't think he likes the idea of conceding that there's any legitimate opposition to him. So he's going to want somebody. I think probably like... my respect for Tim Scott has gone down a bunch in the last couple of weeks. I don't like the way Trump makes everybody kiss the ring and does it up on stage in front of everybody. But, I've always liked Tim Scott. So I think he would if something were to happen and Tim Scott were to become president, I think there'd be a very different tone to the presidency from Donald Trump to Tim Scott. Look, in the end, it's still Trump calling the shots.
People, 90% of Americans vote for president. It does not matter. The idea that you can deliver a state or a demographic, that's simply not true. It's never been true. It's less true now than it's ever been. But you can certainly, if you want to make President Harris the issue, as you did opening up, then contrast her with someone who is least like her, and that would be Pompeo, Ernst, or Cotton. In other words, serious, smart, and not maybe, Tom Cotton is never going to be mistaken for Donald Trump or Kamala Harris. He's just as direct. He destroyed the New York Times in one blow. And Pompeo is direct. And Joni Ernst is direct. I just want someone who can speak for an hour without notes and make sense.
Yeah, and, you know, look at how high our standards have gotten.
I know.
Look at how unrealistic our expectations are. Yeah, you know, like anybody who can you see this person behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office during an emergency? And if your primary criteria is, does this person say enough nice things about Donald Trump? You're not going to end up with a good choice there. That no, really shouldn't be the main criteria.
I got to get my main question in.
Is this person the president most?
There are, unless you can stay another segment. Can you stay another segment this morning, or do you have kids to deliver?
Sure, why not?
Okay, good. Well, then I want to ask my main question. Because it's a very fun question, and I never want to get in a fight with Garrity. That's why his tune is usually Don't Mess Around with Jim, but we played the new tune for Looking Through the Chaos, Jim, the new podcast by Dwayne Patterson and John Campbell, which is up. Jim, how many podcasts do you listen to?
Okay, do you want regularly or do you want intermittent?
Regularly.
Because
subscribe.
Any given day, I'll listen to you.
Subscribe right. to. How many do you subscribe to?
Oh, none. I don't subscribe to things.
Looking Through the Chaos is what you should subscribe. It doesn't cost anything. It just means it shows up in your feed. I'll be right back with Garrity with my one question about the Republican Party. Stay tuned.
Uptown got its hustlers.
Welcome back, America. Jim Garrity is with us for this second segment this morning. Jim, I divide the Republican Party's people who do not like Donald Trump into two categories, Never Trump and Trump Skeptical. The former are best found at the Lincoln Project, which is driven by money, and the Bulwark, which is driven by ideology and money, their business model. They're never Trumpers. They're never going to be other than never Trumpers. They will support Biden. And then in the Trump skeptical column, moving over, I put the Dispatch with Jonah and Stephen Hayes and a group of writers. And then I put National Review, where there are a lot of Trump skeptics, but in the end, they sometimes say good things about Trump skeptics. Are these people amenable to voting for all four of those categories or all four of those mastheads? Will we see nice things about Trump vis-a-vis Biden and Harris between now and November?
Amongst the, you know, Lincoln Project, obviously not. Amongst the Bulwark, rarely, if ever. Once in a great while, you'll see some sort of acknowledge. But I think you're accurate that is their brand. And I would love to see a detailed demographic study of their audience. I think it's safe to say that their audience is primarily most motivated by and most interested in anti-Trump stuff, which probably includes a whole bunch of Democrats and left-leaning independents. And that's fine. I just, you know, if you think of yourself as a conservative website, wasn't their original slogan like conserving conservatism or something like that?
I don't remember, but you've described it accurately.
You'd think once a while you'd write something pro-life. You'd write something, about the value of strict constructionist judges. You think you'd periodically talk about something besides Trump, and it would be policy-oriented, and it would come to it from the perspective of the right. Dispatch, they had an editorial recently in which they argued that both Trump and Biden are unacceptable. We've got two doddering old men, and, we are very friendly competitors with them. I still think the world of Jonah and a bunch of guys over there. So I think it's very unlikely that anyone there will vote for them. I think when they see Trump as having a better position than Biden, perhaps on issues like Israel, you'll see some words of praise. But again, I wouldn't expect it very much. And if you want to characterize National Review as the out of that group, the most Trump friendly or the most open minded, I think that's accurate. I don't think you'll see. Let's say, Ala Pundit, Nick Cottagio, wrote a big piece in which he basically said you have to vote for Biden, as bad as Biden is. I don't think you'll see any. I don't want to speak on behalf of all my colleagues. I'm just one guy. Sometimes we get together and talk about this stuff. But this is, if you're wondering how one of my colleagues is going to vote, better to put the question to them.
Well, it's like Andy McCarthy is no fan of Donald Trump, but Andy is very critical of Alvin Bragg. And he spends a long time saying this is the most nonsensical prosecution. It's a break with the rule of law. And he will take root and branch. He takes to Alvin Bragg because he doesn't care that might help Trump. But he's also along the way saying, by the way, I think Trump's got problems with the, as I do, with the obstruction of justice case in Florida. I think that's the real legal mind hold for him. So objectivity is what I'm looking for. And I think National Review has objectivity. But I don't think that these other three are going to have much of an impact on the election, do you? Because they can't get out of their role playing.
Hugh, as much as I would like to brag, National Review will be influential in the election, and none of these other groups were. I think we should not have any illusions about the impact of any political magazine.
Oh, I disagree. I think this is going to be so close. This is going to be so close that tiny moves of a percent will matter.
I mean, like, in 2020... again, which is pre-January 6th, it is pre-stolen election conspiracy theories, et cetera. National Review has only, we don't endorse every cycle. And so one of my colleagues wrote a yes Donald Trump column. One of my colleagues wrote a maybe Donald Trump column. And one of my colleagues wrote a no Donald Trump column. So that was like, it was a clear, like, and by the way, if we don't endorse, I don't want to talk out of school here, but I want to say if we don't endorse, usually that is a sign that there is not consensus amongst the editors. And when we do endorse, it generally is a sign. Now, when I say consensus, you know, maybe one or two people disagree. You'll see somebody write a rebuttal or a disagreement from an editorial on certain issues and things like that. But by and large, like, so people have said, you know, why didn't you endorse? A lot of people want the National Review to endorse DeSantis. A lot of people would tell me DeSantis lost because National Review wasn't supportive of them. I seriously want these people to get their help for the drug addiction that they need. Because if DeSantis had been still in the race, I would have voted for him.
Jim Garrity. Always fair. Always fair. At Jim Garrity on X, not Twitter, on X. At Jim Garrity. Thank you, Garrity the Indispensable. Also, get the morning jolt from National Review and you'll be fully informed of everything going on in the world of conservatism every day. I'll be right back.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.